I'm Faith Middleton, and this show is about the richness of life. We're going to be talking about the science of sleep. Thanks for listening in Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and New York, including the East End of Long Island. My guest, David K. Randall, decided to wander through one of the most interesting worlds we know and don't know, the world of sleep science. Randall is a riveting curator of all things sleep. Dolphins and birds have the same sleep habits. While one half of their brains are dead asleep, the other halves are full alert, awake, watching for danger. Maybe Woody Allen is a bird. Do scientists know why humans need sleep? If you commit murder while sleepwalking, is it a real crime? I could not put this paper back down. It's called Dreamland. Author, journalist, and professor David Randall, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Oh, so interesting. So let's start with a benchmark here. So humans need, as you point out, how many hours of sleep for every 2 hours that we're awake?
It's basically a 1-to-2 ratio. So you need 1 hour of sleep for every 2 hours you're awake. So that's kind of where we get the 8 hours sleep a night idea.
And we know this from studying the brain?
Exactly. It's both studying the brain and one thing I was surprised by looking at sleep science is most of these studies find out what happens when things go wrong. So it might be not so much, okay, we found out 8 hours of sleep through the study that designed it perfectly. It's, okay, what happens if you get 6 hours of sleep? What happens if you get 5 hours of sleep? And then build from there.
I was so surprised that in the end, science doesn't know why we need to sleep as human beings.
It's one of the biggest mysteries of science. One biologist said that if sleep doesn't perform some absolutely essential function, then it's the greatest mistake evolution ever made. And that function still is a mystery. There's many theories ranging from that's how we consolidate what we've learned each day, to that's how we boost our memories, to this is how we essentially keep our temperature regulated. But no one has been able to pinpoint and say, this is exactly why we need to sleep. There have been studies that find, you know, and they studied rats to find out what happens when rats don't sleep for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And they've discovered that after about 2 weeks, a rat will die of sleep deprivation. And it'll be in a pretty gnarly way. Their body will develop sores. They'll lose a lot of their hair. But the same thing, the scientists don't know exactly what causes it. The theory is that they lose the ability to regulate their bodies, but there's no way to prove that.
And the same is true for humans who are deprived of sleep. I remember reading so much about how different regimes in different countries would break soldiers by depriving them of sleep.
Sleep deprivation is thought to be one of the most effective and brutal forms of torture. In the book, I've read through all these, and I talk about all these different soldiers who talked about, you know, when they were subjected to sleep deprivation, they thought of nothing else but sleep. It was more painful than anything physical they could imagine.
So we get to the stage, this is a final stage of sleep. So there are, I guess, four. And REM is the one, REM is the one we hear so much about. And you can tell you're in REM sleep because if you look over at somebody, rapid eye movements, mm-hmm. against your eyelids. So I read your description. I thought this was amazing about what we do in REM sleep. I'm going to quote you. Your body prepares for REM sleep by sending out hormones to effectively paralyze itself so that your arms and legs don't act out the storyline that you're creating in your head. This attempt at self-protection doesn't always work perfectly. And when that happens, what follows is far from pleasant. Sometimes it is the brain that doesn't get the message. This can lead to waking up in the middle of the night with the frightening sensation that you can't move your limbs. In the Middle Ages, people thought you were, haunted in some way. So at other times, though, the body doesn't fully paralyze itself, does it?
No, that's the form of is a disorder called REM sleep behavior disorder. So essentially, this is when you start acting out the dreams in your head. And this can take strange, very, very strange forms. There are two professors at the University of Minnesota who focus on this, And they have videos of people in the sleep lab who have REM sleep behavior disorder. And you'll see, you know, grown men jumping up on their bed, and acting like a chicken, or, you know, throwing lamps across the room, or belting mm-hmm. Broadway tunes. And this causes, you know, in the real world, this causes many accidents, and police officers don't necessarily know how to react. You know, there have been cases where people have, you know, assaulted their wives or their husbands. It tends to be men who have REM sleep behavior disorder, you know, broken noses, putting somebody in a headlock, things like that. People have, you know, accidentally jumped out of their windows, run through the snow, almost to the point of giving themselves frostbite. And I spoke with some patients who have taken the step of literally tying themselves to the bed each night so that they don't harm themselves or someone else.
So that's one group of people who have this REM sleep disorder. Of all of us, how many of us have some kind of disorder?
It's thought to be that it depends on how you define a sleep disorder. Uh-huh. Sleep apnea, which is essentially the body starts choking itself at night, that's very common. You know, that can be one in every four, one in every three in some areas. And that, again, tends to be men. Men tend to have more sleep problems than women, even though, ironically, women tend to report more issues with their sleep. And generally that's because, you know, the person snoring doesn't know he's snoring, but the person sleeping next to him does, and she's the one who's kind of suffering the immediate consequences. He's suffering consequences, too. He just doesn't realize them. But then when you take it to you know, more serious disorders, even though sleep apnea it can be very serious. In terms of parasomnia, sleepwalking, that's many fewer. You know, that's one out of every 10. And then for somebody who has REM sleep behavior disorder, that's even more rare. That's, you know, 1-3% of the population.
And then there's everyday insomnia.
Exactly. And that's something that almost everybody will suffer through at least once in their lives. There have been studies that show that one out of every two or three people are suffering from insomnia at every one time, and sleeping pills are now one of the most prescribed medications in the U.S. Something like 60 million prescriptions are written every year for them.
So you write in the book that by 2011, not very long ago, there were over 75 recognized sleep disorders, and that number keeps growing. So what are we doing there, do you think? Are we pathologizing sleep too much or getting smarter and smarter about this?
Oh, that's a great question. That kind of takes us back to the idea that sleep, when one thing I was so surprised by when I started looking into this, is actually one of the youngest fields of science. Stanford has one of the best sleep labs and sleep programs in the country, but it actually didn't get up and running until, you know, 5 or 6 years after the computer science division was already up and going. So it kind of shows that sleep is always kind of thought of as, you know, the second thought, we should focus on this third of our lives that we're spending. And part of that was, for so long, it was hard to track what was going on in the brain. You know, when somebody is sleeping there, doctors didn't really know what to do. It wasn't until the 70s or 80s, many doctors kind of thought that their responsibility to the patient ended as soon as the patient fell asleep. There's nothing you could ask them. You can't interview them. Science has developed more ways to see what's happening in the brain while someone is sleeping, to chart his or her breathing patterns, you know, blood pressure, oxygen levels, all these other things. And that's part of the reason why we are discovering, or scientists are discovering more sleep disorders. It's also becoming more interesting. You know, for so long, for sleep scientists, it's kind of seemed like a backwater. You know, what can I really do here? But now they're realizing that there's so many more stages of consciousness than they ever thought possible. Hmm. So it's becoming a booming field. Many sleep scientists now think that the field is in its golden age.
This is David K. Randall. He's author of this book in paperback now called Dreamland. It is a riveting cruise through the science of sleep. Sleep has a huge effect on the brain's decision-making process. So that brings in the military's interest in this, and so many things in our science and medical world come from research that the military are doing. So I want to get to that in just a little bit. We know, as you point out, that just by starting the school day later, as many school systems are doing now, and teenagers need more sleep, that's in all those districts, they're showing higher SAT scores. So this stuff starts to get very, very interesting. But let me get you to do another baseline thing. This business of how we sleep in two parts, you know, sleep one and sleep two, how does that go?
So this comes from a professor at Virginia Tech who basically decided he wanted to study the history of the night. So he looked at everything that happened in a typical night, you know, before we had electric lights, you know, plays, you know, letters, deeds, everything he could think of. And he found that most people used to fall asleep and sleep in two different patterns. You'd fall asleep not long after the sun went down. Then you'd wake up in the middle of the night, maybe 1 or 2 in the morning, and you'd stay up for an hour, and then you'd go back to sleep. And this time you woke up and spent in between was expected. So it was thought of as the first and the second sleep. And then this time in between, it was thought of as actually one of the best parts of people's lives. You know, it was a time for them to sit and reflect or think about their dreams or talk with a loved one or, you know, have sex or whatever else you wanted to do in the middle of the night. And that all seemed to pass after we had electric lights because no longer are we kind of going by the natural rhythms of the planet and, you know, the sun and the stars. We can control this. We can have the light, a bright light on the factory floor for 24 hours a day. We can have the constant conditions. So therefore, we're going to say we're going to sleep in a certain way. You know, Thomas Edison famously thought that sleep was bad for you, even though he never really explained why. But what was really interesting, it was in the 80s, a psychologist in Maryland decided, hey, let's see if there's something here. What happens when you sequester somebody away from electric light? Is there an effect on the brain? And the subjects in the study, you know, for the first couple nights, they were like kids in a candy store. You know, they slept as much as they wanted, making up for all this lost time. But then after a couple days, it became clear that the body started falling back into this pattern that they never knew existed. They would fall asleep not long after the sun went down. Then they would wake up in the middle of the night, and they'd spend about an hour, and they'd fall back asleep. And they described it as so relaxing. And it wasn't just in their heads. You know, scientists actually drew blood when people were awake at this time, and they found that their bloodstreams had higher levels of prolactin, which is the same hormone that chickens have when they're, you know, sitting on an egg in a contented haze.
And you said something about this being that state between the two sleeps, number one and number two, that state in between was the equivalent of what we see in brain scans of people who've been meditating?
Exactly. It seems like it's this time for, you know, the body to naturally give itself a break. You know, I talked about in the book, it was almost as if it's the offstage life of a character in a play. You no longer have to do all these things that you have to do during the day. You don't have responsibilities. You don't have anywhere to be. You can just kind of enjoy life and enjoy being in the moment.
So you can watch your mind. You can watch your thoughts go by, just as meditators do. Oh, boy, this is I can't wait to talk with you about so many things here, especially whether it's a crime if you kill someone while you're sleepwalking, because this has happened quite a lot. We're going to take a quick break and then be right back with the author of Dreamland, Adventures in the Strange Science of Sleep. Find what we talk about on the show online anytime at WNPR.org. Right now, you can see delicious recipes for dinner, value wines, easy cocktails, and much more. Click on programs for the Faith Middleton Show at WNPR.org. And, of course, you'll see the link to the Food Schmooze. We are doing something I can't tell you how fascinating this book is. It's one of the most interesting books I've read in a long time. This is David K. Randall. He's a journalist and professor and also author of this book in paperback now called Dreamland, A Riveting Cruise Through the Science of Sleep. David, I want to get at something. We just talked about left to our own devices, if we removed all the screens, TVs, computers, the electric light bulb, we would go back to that sort of farm style of the natural body rhythm of going to sleep at around sundown, waking up midway through the night for a little while, and then back to sleep you go until till dawn, let's say. Well, here's the issue about gender. Most studies that have been done in medicine have been done on men. And a good friend said to me when I was explaining this part of your book, she said, yeah, but as women, we all know that, you know, we get up, and men too, this is because of prostate, but we get up 20 times to go to the bathroom. And as we age, we wake up more. So how does that get figured into this equation?
That's a great question. As you age, everybody, men and women, will wake up more. And it's a big part. Some of it is because, prostate or having to go through the bathroom or something else. But it's also that your circadian rhythm changes. We all have this inner clock that tells us, when to get up, when to go to sleep, when to get sleepy. And that shifts throughout our lives. Most people, remember being a teenager, it seemed impossible to wake up before 9 or 10, and it was, brutal to fall asleep before midnight or so. And then, suddenly you're 45 or 50, and you realize that, okay, it's actually pretty easy to wake up, and trying to stay up past midnight is much harder now. So that's part of the reason, and that cycle continues as you get older, that you're going to typically wake up more and more, and you're going to spend less time in deep sleep. In the book, I make a joke that it seems like as soon as, biology's dark joke is that as soon as you have time to sleep as much as you want because you're retired, you no longer can get that deep sleep that you really wanted. Mm. So that's one of the big reasons for it. And then in terms of gender, everybody, women as much as men get affected by bright lights, which is one of the main reasons why our sleep patterns are different now. In the book, one of the more interesting studies I came across, it was done by researchers in Israel, and they found that a woman who lived in a place where it was basically bright enough at night to read a book outside had a much higher chance of developing breast cancer. Mm-hmm. And they tried to control for all these other things, location and education and health and everything else, and they couldn't pinpoint it on anything else but the exposure to light. And the theory basically was that because women who were living in these areas were never getting as much deep sleep, then somehow that was affecting their body's ability to maintain their cells and the integrity of their cells, and that therefore led to cancer.
Yeah. When I was in Las Vegas, I was in the Venetian, and they have a fake plaza in Venice there, and the lighting designers are geniuses, and they created true twilight. And it really is an amazing thing to see. And I mean, it's gorgeous. And as I was sitting at the cafe table in this fake twilight, I said to the waitress, "Hey, is this weird? You've probably been here a long time. Is this weird?" And she said, "I cannot, my body doesn't know what to do. I can't sleep when I go home. I'm completely confused." She said, "This is a little depressing."
That's true, and shift workers always complain about that. There was another study I wrote about in the book where nurses who worked the late shift, the midnight shift, were more likely to develop certain type of cancers and all these other, bad health outcomes, for lack of a better way of saying it. And you know, these are nurses. They knew what they should put in their bodies. They knew how to live, and they were affected by it too. And you know, truckers who have one of the hardest jobs in the U.S. Sleep schedules are a huge part of how they do their job, and it's becoming more and more regulated because it directly impacts the safety of not only them but everybody else on the highway.
The unintended consequences of our inventions, that's one of the things you've made me think about. You talked about Edison's light bulb, and then suddenly the night that it had been a time to sleep suddenly becomes, for our culture, a party time.
Exactly. And in the book I talked about, it's, you know, kind of goes to the time before. We had this kind of fear of the night. You know, that's where all the danger was. You know, people literally would lock themselves in their houses at night. They would lock the city gates. And then suddenly night is the time when all the good stuff happens. And you have this idea that if I can do whatever I want at any time, why should I ever sleep? And we haven't really, as a culture, come to the grips with there are many consequences of that. And maybe they're not as obvious as, you know, drinking. And, you know, drinking and driving, it's pretty obvious that somebody's impaired. But if somebody's sleep driving with only 3 or 4 hours of sleep, it's not as obvious. You can't, you know, blow into a breathalyzer and tell as easily that somebody could be making just as poor decisions, if not worse.
And then, because you have these light bulbs, businesses, factories decide, well, there's no reason why we shouldn't make our products through the night, and suddenly they're demanding that workers work through the night. You describe a scene where in one company, and then, of course, unions get into the picture because they say, hey, that's not fair to people. So you describe a scene where in one factory, didn't they have a wire or a rope, and you could sit on a bench and put your arms on this wire or rope, and then just put your head down, and that was the way they let you take a break to sleep.
Exactly. And the funny thing was people paid for this privilege, which implied that it was better than the alternative.
In the factory?
In the factory, yeah. And there's also, you know, human resources executives at Fortune 500 companies that I spoke with said that this kind of fatigue management is going to be only a bigger and bigger issue as the world becomes more and more connected. You already see it in energy companies and transportation companies. You know, ExxonMobil has people working around the world at any time of day, and they need to have their pumps working at all times. You know, American Airlines has pilots flying across the world at any time. So they have very intricate schedules over workers and how long they're working, how long they can work. Especially because when they make a mistake, you know, lives are immediate danger. But you're going to probably see this in more companies as well. You know, the consultants and executives both say that this is something that is on their radar, and it's becoming more and more clear what happens when someone is not sleeping well, that there can be consequences. Maybe they're not fatal, but they can also be mistakes that cost billions of dollars.
That brings us to the military. You describe a man whose name I can't remember at the moment, who made a presentation, I think, was it to the generals? I forget where. And they wanted to hear how they could optimize soldier performance based on sleep habits. And what did they learn?
So this was Thomas Balkin. He's a civilian who works at Walter Reed. And he basically developed a form of tracking a soldier's sleep habits and sleeping in the field. So there have been studies going back to the 1950s where the military has tried to track, okay, what happens when a soldier is not getting as much sleep in the field as normal? And they've found that almost every measure of good performance drops significantly. There was one study where, you know, they had two soldiers in different rooms, and they had to communicate. One had a map, and the other had the directions. So they had to work together if they were going to ever get anywhere. And they discovered that after, you know, moderate sleep deprivation, they just simply weren't communicating. You know, somebody wasn't enunciating clearly. The other person wasn't listening. They were getting angry at each other. They both insisted that they were right. And this just can't happen if you're going to win a war, much less, you know, drive down the street. So the solution that he came up with, Thomas Balkin, was basically for soldiers to wear a wristwatch-sized apparatus that tracks how much they've slept, how long it's been since they last went to sleep, and predicts what their performance is going to be based on that information. So if you can say, okay, here's my group of 10 soldiers, and we know we have a mission in 6 hours, and that mission's going to take several hours, I can either tell them, okay, we need you to take a nap now, get your rest, and then we're going to wake up 3 hours from now and go on out. Or I can say, okay, we know this mission's going to take longer, and you're not going to get adequate sleep, so we're going to give you some kind of stimulant to help you stay awake, whether that's that stimulant can take several forms. And this has shown, this presentation was made to NATO, was made to the U.S. military itself, and it's expected to be, this wristwatch monitoring system is expected to be part of the standard soldier's gear by 2020 or so.
Yeah, I wonder if the number of people killed in the military from friendly fire, our own forces, it's very high. What is it? What's the statistic on that?
During the first Iraq war, it was about 1 in 4. There was one famous case where there was a tank battle in the middle of the night, and the American soldiers, the American tank forces, they were coming across Iraqis who simply didn't have anything close to the same technological ability. They didn't have GPS. They couldn't see in the dark. They couldn't do all these other things that the Americans could do. But in the confusion of battle, the tank commanders, one tank kind of veered off to the side and ended up shooting at their own American tanks. And one tank was destroyed, and the American military, they didn't know immediately that it was friendly fire, so they decided to investigate, wondering if perhaps the enemy had some weapon that they just didn't anticipate. And they discovered that, the shells that destroyed the tank could have only come from another American tank. So this idea was that you can have all the training in the world, you can have all the technology in the world, you can have the best equipment in the world, but if the person manning that is sleep deprived, it's all good. That all those advantages that you've built up are suddenly going to disappear.
Let's come back for a second to the way that we're now building our homes. I'm talking with David K. Randall. He teaches journalism and is also author of this book and paperback, so fascinating, called Dreamland, Adventures in the Strange Science of Sleep. A science does not know why we human beings need to sleep. Yet there is so much that we do know. And David, you've done such a good job. So interesting. So the Home Builders Association, this gets to our habits now. There are all kinds of things, as you mentioned, that go on in the bedroom in terms of sleep behavior. Some people have apnea. Some people have snoring. Some people kick or move around a lot. All kinds of things. You get two individuals together and this stuff's going to happen. Somebody's noisy and somebody's not. Well, then I read here from you that the National Association of Home Builders has surveyed architects and construction companies. And what do they find out? That by 2016, so in about a year and a half, more than half of all new custom-built homes in the U.S. will have separate master bedrooms. So this is kind of a secret, I think. Go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's true that someone I spoke with basically said, the architect knows, the landscaper knows, but the family doesn't want everybody else to know too. And the idea is that, it's hard as you get older and older, you tend to value your sleep more. It's harder just to say, I'm just going to push on through it and drink another cup of coffee or something. And you maybe say, I don't want to make the same compromises that I've been making forever. If someone sleeping next to you is snoring, you want to share your bed. You maybe don't want to share your bed. You want to get this good sleep. And people say that, people I spoke with said this was the way to save my marriage. It wasn't, this outdated idea of that, we have sleep in separate rooms, something's wrong with us. It's, I value you, I love you, I want to be the best version of myself, and that requires me to get sleep that I can't get when I'm sharing a bed with somebody who kicks me.
And this is where gender came in again, you say, that that when women did not have a good night's sleep for whatever reason, the entire next day was affected.
Exactly. It was one sociologist said, you know, he linked this to saying that women tend to control the emotional fibers of a relationship and they're more in tune, where maybe men are just kind of go about their day, and if they're sleepy, they're just kind of slumped down on the couch or something. One thing that was really interesting, though, in some of these studies was that, you know, researchers would take a couple and they'd have them sleep in a separate room for one night, and then they'd have them sleep in the same room the next night. And they would ask them, okay, where did you sleep? Where did you have more quality sleep? And couples by and by said, you know, I enjoyed sleeping in the same bed with my partner more. But their brain waves said something different. They said that, you know, they actually got much better sleep, higher quality sleep, when they were sleeping alone. So it seemed like this conflict between the heart and the head. And researchers kind of came together, and the way they kind of pieced this together is that there is, you know, you're probably going to get better sleep if you're sleeping in a bed by yourself, because you can have everything the way you want it. You can have the temperature you want. You can have all the space you want. But there's also something discomforting about sharing a bed with somebody else. You know, mm-hmm. It's this idea that we're all actors, and this is a way we're kind of backstage, and we don't have to play all these different roles. You can just kind of be yourself and share that time with somebody else. There's a real value to that as well.
Yeah, economists talk about this too with houses. To own your own home is not necessarily a great financial deal in the end, and yet we do it because of our emotional need to have home. So stay right with us, David. We're going to come right back to you. We'll take a quick break and then more on Dreamland, Adventures in the Strange Science of Sleep. Stay with us.
Sing a lullaby. Once there was a way to give back home. Once there was a way. Sing a lullaby.
I'm Faith Middleton. Thank you so much for listening. And also thanks to our talented crew, senior producer Lori Mack and producer Jonathan McNichol. Here's what we're doing. We're talking to David K. Randall. He's author of this paperback, which was New York Times bestseller when it first came out. It's called Dreamland, Adventures in the Strange Science of Sleep. And it is absolutely fascinating to read all these things about this thing we do. Science doesn't know why human beings sleep. You know, why isn't it that we can't just rest, go on a beach, and rest our bodies and our organs? And, you know, why do we actually need sleep? What goes on? What is the restoration during the process of sleep? David, what do you think it is? Because it's clear that through dreaming, through that sleep state, there is a lot of learning that goes on, that we can process problems, we can test our anxieties. What do you think we're getting when we're sleeping?
I think that's probably one of the key parts. One scientist, he was a professor at Harvard Medical School. He did one of the studies that I thought was most fascinating. He had subjects play Tetris, you know, the game where you have to fit all the shapes in the right lines.
Yeah.
Had play Tetris before they went to sleep. And then he woke them up in the middle of the night to ask, you know, what were you dreaming about? And at the beginning of each night, it was pretty literal replay, you know, saying, I saw falling shapes, I heard, you know, this Russian music. But then later in the night, you know, maybe 5 or 6 in the morning before they would naturally wake up, the dreams had changed. You know, they were now much less a literal replay and more of a subjective, saying, okay, I had all these books, I had my favorite books, and I had to put them in the right order, or something else that had the same basic blueprint of Tetris, but it was then meshed with everything that goes on in your normal life. And he said that this was a sign that dreaming and sleep was basically a way to consolidate what we've learned. You know, the brain is going through what it went through each day and trying to pick out, you know, what was important and what it can toss. You know, it's basically the brain is a filing cabinet. You only have so much space, and each day you have so much information that you could jam it full every day.
And would that be facts and emotions?
That'd be both fact and emotion, and experiential learning, whatever that is. A blend of fact and emotion. And if we never were able to clear our brains for the next day, then we would never be able to function. So I think that one of the key aspects of sleep is this way to kind of prepare for the next day, to consolidate what we've learned, and also to come up with new ideas. You know, when you've kind of sorted out what's inessential from your day and focused and only can focus on what you need to keep, then you can make connections that weren't obvious before. And, you know, this is something that now businesses are focusing on. You know, Nike and Google famously now let people nap at work, not because they're lazy or anything, but because they realize that the biggest asset that these companies have is in the brains of their workers, and they want those brains to be functioning at their highest level. And one thing you can do to push that forward is to let someone sleep and see these new connections.
And that's not just theory, I gather. You say in the book, subjects who've been allowed to take naps have finished mazes faster, have become less emotional when confronted with disturbing images, and have remembered a longer list of words than their peers who hadn't been allowed to doze off.
Exactly. One of my favorite studies, too, they had business students, students who were going for their MBA, play this video game, essentially, and they were trying to, expand their business, their fake business, as quickly as they could. But halfway through the game, the rules of the marketplace changed. So what was working before suddenly no longer worked, but it also made your business plummet. So you had to adapt, or you weren't going to survive. Students who were able to take a nap when they came back, they were able to deal with it. You know, they kind of rode the wave. They knew what to do, how to shift and change. But those who weren't able to sleep, they became more and more fixed in their mindset. They said, okay, this has to work, so I'm going to keep doubling down, even though it's literally shooting myself in the foot.
We see Spain arguing about this right now. They have for the past year, but right at the moment where in Spain, the lunchtime is long and their economy is in trouble. And so economists are saying we've got to change this. We've got to make the lunchtime much shorter. So they're cutting back on naps so that we match the rest of Europe and so that we can be competitive in the world. What they're not talking about is whether the worker in Spain is more efficient having had that nap.
Yeah, that's a great point. So much of the emphasis is now we have to be on the same hours as somebody else. You know, we can't be working until 9 o'clock at night and expect, us to work seamlessly with other countries. But it is hard to say, to pinpoint, where exactly is the line between being efficient and being detrimental to your body and your abilities.
So let's talk about sleepwalking, because I promised we would. As you point out, when someone is sleepwalking, the parts of the brain that control movement and control spatial awareness are awake, but the parts of the brain responsible for consciousness are still asleep. So that's how you get to perform a physical activity, and yet you're still asleep. Those are the two things that are happening. There have been, as you mentioned earlier in this conversation, incidents where people have done very violent things while sleepwalking. They don't know they're doing them, allegedly. And so this has included murder. And there, you cite a couple of cases where people have been found innocent because they were sleepwalking. When they woke up and realized what had happened, walked into a police department and said, "Oh my God, I've just done this horrible thing." And the police, to their credit, said, "This is odd. This is you're not acting like a normal criminal," and investigated. And the jury ends up finding the person innocent. It's amazing.
It's amazing, too, that so the brain basically can be in two states of consciousness at once, and scientists are still kind of piecing this together. And it's not only, you know, there are the most bizarre cases, which is, you know, the Ken Parks cases, the one you're talking about, where he drove, you know, 15 miles to his in-law's house and ended up stabbing his mother-in-law to death and almost choked his father-in-law to death, and then was acquitted because he claimed he was sleepwalking the entire time, and, you know, including when he was driving. One thing people are always amazed by is that, you know, sleepwalkers, they're not with their arms out in front of them like a zombie. You know, they have their eyes open. They can walk up and down stairs. They just have no conscious thought. But what's interesting, too, not only is it when somebody hurting other people, there have been more and more cases where somebody is hurting themselves, and it becomes an issue of, you know, scientists call it pseudo-suicide, where somebody, you know, mm-hmm. might jump off a building, you know, if they're in a hotel or something, and the relatives then say, you know, I never saw this coming, what was going on? And there are also many, many cases where police officers, many of whom have the habit of sleeping with, you know, with their firearm maybe on their bedside table or on their desk or something else, start sleepwalking and they pick up the gun and they shoot themselves or they shoot somebody else. And it's for police, the law enforcement, it becomes a question of, okay, was this, you know, something that somebody should have foreseen, or were they part of an accident that, you know, bystander to something that their body did without their control?
Imagine being that person who's done this thing to another. How you live with that it must be so difficult. At the end, you talk in the book about counting sheep. The book is called Dreamland, by the way. This thing where every night, two of every five adults in the U.S. have problems falling asleep and staying asleep. And these have nothing to do with sleep disorders. It has more to do, I think, as you say, with the pressure to be asleep. We are starting to know how important sleep is. We're tired and yet keyed up. And so your mind starts working. And we've had sleep experts on the show who say, look, after 30 minutes, if you're not asleep and you've been trying really hard, which sets you up not to sleep, you're not asleep and you have sleep medicine, maybe it's a good time to take it. Or maybe it's a good time to do your stress relaxation routine, because your brain is on this automatic pilot and it's not going to do it.
Exactly. Insomnia is now thought of as almost an ironic mental condition, that you want sleep so badly that you can't get it. And researchers have been able to induce sleep insomnia and patients by basically saying, you know, as simple as, okay, we want to time how fast you can fall asleep, and then somebody is impossible for them to fall asleep. So one thing, you know, it kind of goes back to what we were talking about earlier in this first and second sleep. Sometimes people fall asleep, wake up in the middle of the night, 2 o'clock in the morning or so, and they think, oh my God, I'm awake, I have to go back to sleep right now, and I'm to count, if, you know, if I fall asleep right now, I can get another 3 hours and I'll be fine. And that pressure makes it impossible for them to fall back asleep. And then they, you know, start taking an Ambien, or they start taking some other sleeping pill. But they also might not realize that sometimes it actually is completely normal to wake up in the middle of the night and mm-hmm. be up for half an hour and then go back to sleep. So sometimes people start medicating a condition that comes standard on the human body.
And doctors, too, you say, will start writing a prescription, even though this is the body's natural state to wake up in the middle of the night.
Exactly. And one thing with sleeping pills, too, it doesn't solve the problem. You know, many sleeping pills are, you know, this says on the label, for short-term use, but people use them chronically. You know, as soon as their prescription runs out, then all this anxiety comes back, and they think, oh, my God, how am I ever going to fall asleep without my Ambien or my Lunesta or whatever else? So researchers have found that a type of therapy called cognitive behavioral therapy is actually much more effective at preventing insomnia over the long run and keeping somebody from, you know, falling back into that habit. And essentially it helps you, as opposed to being, you know, the audience member of your sleep, you kind of become the director, saying, okay, this is how I'm going to visualize, I'm going to fall asleep this way, I'm going to do my relaxation techniques, I'm going to do all these other things that help me kind of take control of it and fall asleep without relying on this crutch.
You can see why it's a hard choice for people when they think all I have to do is pop a pill. Or I have to go through this whole routine of learning all this. And so people opt for the pill, which then can affect memory. It really only gets you to sleep an extra 17 minutes. And if it's not time release, which can be a bad idea because it keeps you groggy all day, if it's not time release, doesn't help you with early morning awakening. It's a terrible thing. That's why so many people are having such trouble sleeping, A and B. Look at all this money these sleep companies are making.
Exactly. Sleeping pills, you know, they obviously can help some people, but I think, you know, so many of the research now shows that many of the benefits of them are psychological, that you can take them because you think it's going to help you fall asleep better. When studies show that you fall asleep about 10 minutes faster and stay asleep for about 10 minutes longer, and that's maybe not the best trade-off for all the things that it does to you. You know, sleeping pills work essentially by preventing you from forming short-term memories. So you can be tossing and turning just as much as you were before. Mm-hmm. Your brain's just not capturing that into your memory at all. So when you wake up, there's a blank slate. You think, you know, a blank slate means I slept, so I can just get up and go about my day, and not realizing that you might be groggy because the drugs might still be in your system, or you might be groggy because you were tossing and turning and just simply don't remember it.
And you've had your own bouts with sleepwalking, I gather.
Yeah, I've always been a sleep talker, and it wasn't until a couple of years ago I started, you know, becoming mobile. And I woke up one night with a bad pain in my knee on my back in the hallway, and I realized I had sleptwalked into one of our hallway walls. And I went to my doctor and said, you know, I'm sleepwalking. What can you do? I spent a night in the sleep lab. I came back. He said, okay, it's clear you're not having seizures. You don't have sleep apnea. So basically all I can do, tell you to do is take it easy, and, you know, I don't know what else to do for you. And it felt like I had, you know, sleepwalked past the medical frontier. You know, I was past where science could help me. So I wanted to find out why was something that seems so simple, you know, why isn't sleep like digestion, which seems pretty basic? Why is this big blank mark? You know, a third of my life was going by unexamined and unaccounted for, and I wanted to know more about it.
Ah, oh, so interesting. I wanted to say that I think this book would be terrific for book clubs. What a discussion. Every time since I read your book that I bring this up with people, it starts the most amazing conversation. So it's Dreamland by David K. Randall. So David, what do you do now? How do you think about sleep after having done all this research? So interesting. How do you, you know, does that make it more pressured for you in going to sleep because you know full well how important this is to functioning at your peak? You know, how do you look at it now?
Oh, definitely. It's, the funny thing is that, you know, when the book came out, the hardback came out in 2012 and the paperback came out more recently. When the book came out, actually, I had a newborn at home. So At the time, I knew so much about sleep, I was not able to get it. And I knew exactly why I couldn't get it, and I knew why it was so hard for him to get. Because, you know, your brain, when you're that little, it takes a while to even learn the difference between light and dark and get on a sleep schedule at all. But now, you know, he's sleeping better, and we're all sleeping better. It's a crucial part of my day. You know, I don't drink caffeine anymore for a reason, mm-hmm. because I don't want it to affect how I'm sleeping. In some ways, I become the most boring person in the world because I know it's 10 o'clock and I need to sleep. And, you know, even though I want to watch another episode of House of Cards, I know it'll keep me up.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I'm also able to function better. Science now sees that sleep and getting the right amount of sleep is one of the best forms of preventative medicine. You know, whether that's depression or Parkinson's or obesity or whatever else, if it seems so simple and it also feels pretty good to get good sleep, why wouldn't I do that?
Yeah, and if you think this is all a joke, think about Monday Night Football. As you point out in the book, West Coast and East Coast teams, when the East Coast has to travel to the West Coast usually wins the game.
Yeah, the West Coast players are at a disadvantage, and they don't even realize it because they're basically their circadian rhythm is at a different time. And studies have shown that when you're at your peak of your circadian rhythm, you can jump a little bit farther, you can swim a little bit faster, you can lift a little bit heavier weights. Oh. And, you know, in the Olympics, you saw athletes who tried to essentially game their sleep cycles so that they're performing at the best time.
Thank you so much, David Randall, for being on the show. Great job on this book. Dreamland in paperback. As always, this show is about the richness of life. You can find the books, people, recipes, the whole works right on our website now at WNPR.org. Click on programs. In New Haven, I'm Faith Middleton.